Every religion in the world has a drink appropriate to it. Christianity and Judaism are wine. Islam is coffee. Hinduism, milk, or maybe pung. And Buddhism is tea. Appropriately enough, because Buddhism is the way of awakening, the word Buddha means the awakened one, and tea keeps you awake. Especially the kind of tea that is drunk in tea ceremony, where you don't drink steeped tea, but powdered tea, very finely powdered, which is whipped in with the water. So you drink the actual tea. And there's a kind of it called koicha, which is drunk very thick, almost like spinach soup. And that really keeps you awake. I recommend it instead of methadrine. The legend is, of course, that Bodhidharma, who is supposed to have brought the Zen type of Buddhism from India to China, somewhere after 450 AD, perhaps, if he really was a historical character, that one night he was meditating and fell asleep. And in a great fury, when he woke, he cut off his eyelids and threw them to the ground, and they sprang up as the first tea plant. For, as you know, the leaf of the tea is rather shaped like an eyelid. And in the course of time, it became customary for Zen monks to drink tea to keep themselves awake during long spells of meditation. And as the behavior in a Zen monastery is rather ritualistic and formal, the way they drank tea became in due course ceremonious. And then, much later, the drinking of tea in this way became a ceremony also for lay people. And it was modeled in this way by the great Senno Rikyu, and from him descend at least five different schools of the tea ceremony through various branches of his family. Some of them very formal and very difficult, such as the common, best-known Urasenke school, which is the dominant school in Japan today, and which is the kind of tea ceremony that you ordinarily see when somebody puts on a performance. I find it excessively affected, very uncomfortable, and is mostly practiced by young ladies as a sort of accomplishment which they learn to be a lady. But it's painful. It's very, very stiff and formal. On the other end is the Kankyu-an school, which is it's very elegant, but much less formal. Much easier, but practiced with enormous skill. And then there is a kind of tea ceremony still served by Zen monks and literary men who are just entertaining their friends, artists and so on, which is very informal indeed. And that's the kind I shall be showing you. Now, the interesting thing is that this ceremony has no obviously religious character. It is quite secular. It is just drinking tea and having pleasant conversation in surroundings of peacefulness and simplicity. And this derives from an essential aspect of Zen. And I want you to try and understand the blending of ritual with simplicity, first of all. There was a Houston Smith, you know, who's a professor of philosophy at MIT, was traveling in Japan, and a Zen master was showing him around, and he noticed that every time they passed the image of a Buddha or Bodhisattva in the temple, the Zen master stopped and bowed to it. And Houston Smith said, "I can't understand why you go through this ritual of bowing to things. I thought you Zen people were above all rituals. You know, I'd just as soon spit at it." And the master said, "You spits, I bows." So, here is this question. Why ritual And why does Zen have a peculiar penchant for expressing itself in a secular way? Now, ritual, to begin with, is something that makes Americans uncomfortable. I remember as a minister at one time, whenever I went out to dinner, they asked me to say grace. And after saying grace, there was a ghastly silence. And I had to start the conversation flowing easily again. Because there's something, I don't know, I can't find a proper adjective for an attitude which Protestants have to ritual. They don't have much, but they have some. But when they do it, they look down their noses and feel that somehow an element has entered into things of a Godhead who is wagging the finger at you and saying, you should at this moment think seriously about whether you've been good or not. And so everybody is then reminded uncomfortably by some words addressed to the good Lord that they really are all too human after all, and somehow God makes everybody uncomfortable. That's why they're getting rid of him and announcing that he's dead. Of course, that kind of God never lived, even, except in people's imaginations. But this idea, you see, of being watched all the time by a loving but severely judging father. You know how it is when you were children in school and you were writing at your desk, and the teacher, however much you respected the teacher, wandered around and looked over your shoulder while you were working. It puts you off completely. You want to show the finished product. And leave me alone while I get it together. As a saying, never show anything unfinished to children or fools. So, in the same way, this God makes everybody feel uncomfortable, and therefore any ritual in which the Lord is invoked, it makes people feel uncomfortable, and it passes on from that to many Americans are quite uncomfortable at a formal dinner. You dress up in black tie and tuxedo and everything is served in order and the wine is properly handled and all that sort of thing. It's very beautiful. But people feel that somehow it's affected. And Americans like to give the impression of being folksy, sincere, down to earth, no nonsense, you see. And so frills are regarded as unessential. But we have thereby impoverished our life enormously. And also, we don't handle things skillfully as a result. We are clumsy. Because actually, ritual is a mood that comes into any action performed with complete awareness. I don't mean that you stare at what you're doing and concentrate on it with effort, but a ritual to a thing helps you to do it in an orderly way, just as a practical matter. And also, it is a way of turning everyday action into meditation. And Zen is particularly keen on this, that meditation is not just sitting for so long and concentrating on a koan or on nothing. Zen is everyday life, and the enlightened Zen person doesn't make any distinction between the nirvana world of final reality and the samsara world of everyday life. Therefore, to understand this, you must first realize that it is a basic principle of Zen that you're it, that this whatever it is, to which nobody gives a name, because well, it's been called suchness, it's been called emptiness, it's been called the Tao, the way of nature. But it's fundamental for Zen that you do not think about it. That is to say, you don't have any concept of it. Because that which we really are, and which all things are, you might say the fundamental energy of the universe, is so basic that if you have an idea of it, it must be wrong. Just in the same way that you cannot bite your own teeth, that you cannot look into your own eyes without using a mirror, that you cannot see the color of the inside of your head. So that which is absolutely fundamental, which is you, must not be conceptualized, and you don't need to get it. You don't need to hang on to it. You don't need to cling to it, Rock of Ages, cleft for me, or anything like that. Because it's what you are, and it's what there is, and all that there is. And that's you. And it is subject to, or rather, it appears as something and nothing, as solid and space, as light and darkness, as life and death. The yang, or positive force, and the yin, or negative force, are its outward manifestation. And as you well know, you can't have yang without yin, or yin without yang. You can't have life without death, or death without life, or solid without space, or space without solid. They are polarized, like the north and the south pole of a magnet. And so, just because they go together, however different they may look, nonetheless, they are inseparable. And this indicates that there is something mysterious between them, a sort of conspiracy. But nobody can say what it is, because all thinking is either black or white, or grey, which is just a muddle. What it is in common between black and white, between inside and outside, between up and down, that can never be stated. Because everything we can talk about, we talk about it by putting it in a box called classification. We sort our experiences into pigeonholes, animal, vegetable, mineral. You see? Is or isn't. Is you is or is you ain't. And what it is that cannot be sorted into any pigeonhole, because it is what is in common between the inside of the box and the outside, we have no way of conceiving. And therefore, for this reason, Zen does not take any image, any idea, or any doctrine with essential seriousness. It has nothing to say, only to show. And what it shows you is what you see all the time and you can't miss. Because there it is, and here it is. I am it, and you are it, and he is it, and she is it, and it is it, and this is it, and that is that. That's a poem by James Broughton. Now, but you see, in the ordinary way, people don't feel any confidence in this, because we are beguiled by the multiplicity of things that we see around us, by this as distinct from that, by life as distinct from death, by light as distinct from darkness, and we think that the universe is an energy, and energy is a thing that's apt to get tired, wear out, run out, like an electric battery runs out, or the gas runs out of your car. Therefore, we always feel that the universe is very precarious, and that the positive side may easily lose and fizzle out, and only the negative side will remain, and that blackness and non-being may swallow everything up. Well, to the Chinese, that's a perfectly fantastic notion, because the moment you get to the deepest dark, you generate the seed of the brightest light. That's why in the yin-yang, the circle with the S-curve through the middle, you see the black half and the white half. And in the bulge of the circle, like the eye of a fish, there is a dot of the opposite color. That is the seed of being within non-being, and the seed of non-being within being. Lao Tzu says, to be and not to be arise mutually. It isn't that there is first nothing and then something. Or it might come in that order, but that's like saying that the egg comes before the hen. In a way it does. And you can say that a hen is one egg's way of becoming other eggs. But it doesn't make any difference where you begin. It's always the same thing, because life is a pulsating process. The tiniest pulsations of the propagation of light through deep sounds where you can hear the pulsations, to much longer pulsations, day and night, and finally the coming and going of universes. So one is beguiled. Because, you see, what is common to everything that you see? Well, of course, we say sight is common to everything that we see. But we don't see the color of our eyes, I mean of the lens. Because we say that's transparent. If your lens was rose-colored, everything would look rosy until you got used to it. And then it would be just ordinary, except that you wouldn't be able to differentiate reds very clearly. If our eye lens has a color, we don't know what it is. But it's basic to everything. What is the sound of the ear? It's empty. Same way with the color of your head. It's empty. It isn't black, it isn't white, just empty. And so too, when you hear music on the radio or talk on the radio, that is all the vibration of a diaphragm. Every kind of sound is that diaphragm vibrating. But the diaphragm's own sound isn't heard. And nobody announces that these sounds that you are hearing are the vibrations of a diaphragm. So you see, what is basic, absolutely basic, to all experience, to all our senses, to everything, cannot be named, cannot be classified, and therefore, because of that, you forget about it. You lose it. You think that the reality is all the multiplicity of things. But the substratum, what Tillich calls the ground of being, which is his decontaminated word for God, seems not to be there at all. And so we've forgotten that that is you. And the object of Zen is to rediscover that. But to rediscover it in such a way that you do not grasp it in terms of some formula, in terms of some ideas, or even in terms of some particular practice. Because this thing has no terms. And therefore you have to find it by ceasing to grasp yourself or your life in any way, by totally letting go. And of course that takes a lot of nerve. And the discipline of Zen has various functions, but one of them is to convince you by hard work that there is no way whatsoever of getting hold of this thing. I remember Krishnamurti saying the same thing when I was having a talk with him once. He was sitting on a couch and he had a couple of cushions. And he took one cushion and put it over here and said, "Now this is real meditation. This is marvelous," he said. "It comes in wave after wave after wave. It is marvelous beyond belief. Now this," he said, "this is a sort of preliminary meditation. And this," he said, "is to understand beyond any shadow of doubt that there is nothing, 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 nothing you can do about it." But you see, until you know you can't, you always have a sneaking suspicion that you can. So then, when you have discovered through hard work that nothing can be done, then you let go and you discover it. Only, as the Mumon Khan Zen textbook says, you are like a dumb man who has had a marvelous dream. Everybody who's had a marvelous dream wants to explain it. Tell the story, but you're dumb. You can't say. Your mouth isn't big enough. It would have to be so big that your head would disappear when you opened it. So then, when this is understood, two things happen. One, all the energy that hitherto you expended on holding on to yourself and being anxious becomes available for something else. And you feel zoom, this huge influx of energy. And it's available for just living. Second thing is, there's a curious kind of interior quietness goes along with this energy. A sense that there is nowhere to go. Where's your rush? It's here. In other words, that this room in which you're sitting now and this particular time of day in New York City in November 1966 is what there is. Because this, the basic reality, is not in time. It's always now. You can't measure it with a clock any more than you can catch space in a sieve. It eludes all measurement. But it is just now. And here it is, you see. So we are here. And the thing is, actually, this is no different from us. I don't want you to imagine some sort of formless gloop that underlies all particularity. The particularity is not different from this. Nor is it quite the same. Sameness and difference don't apply to this which is beyond all categories. But in a very real sense, this here now is it. And so, please, here you are, see? There's nowhere else to go, nothing else to attain, or anything. You have it. It's here. So enjoy it. And then you see, when that happens, you, although you have an enormous energy which is available for anything you want to do, nevertheless, you just don't feel compelled to get up and fidget with it. You can also just sit. And then you discover that your mind stops scheming. You see, in the ordinary way, when we just let our thoughts run around as we ordinarily do, we are constantly scheming. How to get this thing arranged, how to control that, that you shouldn't be sitting here now because there's something more important that you should do, at least be improving your mind by reading a good book. And so this constant scheming goes on, and because there is in the head a long, long chattering, you only see the world in a very limited way. Because when you think, your thought is always selective. And it picks out this as a thing, and that as a thing to notice, and the other thing as a thing to notice. And this is something important to do, and that is a more important event than other events, you see. And as a result, you only notice what you think about. And so you are hardly noticing at all. In fact, there's a certain noticing, you see, always means selecting. Selecting something as being important to look at or think about. But when you stop doing that, you discover that life is much richer than you thought it was. You see, when a tailor went to see the Pope, they asked him, what is he like? Oh, he said, he's about a size 40. Because he sees from the point of view of his interest. And every one of us has a certain kind of interest in terms of which we see and select what we think it's important for us to look at. But the world is an infinity. There are innumerable ways of looking at it, and then there is no way at all of looking at it. And that is, of course, the maximum vision. So when you let your thoughts go, you do this by allowing them to think of anything they like. And so when thought is not being pushed in a certain direction, it eventually subsides. And you find yourself sensing, yes, hearing, seeing, but you don't think about it. You just see. You let your eyes see, look at whatever they want to look at. You let your ears hear whatever they want to hear. And you let your sense of touch feel whatever it wants to feel. You let go of it all, you see. And then in the quietude that follows from this, you make some very surprising discoveries. And these discoveries are the basis of the tea ceremony. Namely, that the most ordinary things are magical. The great masters of the tea ceremony are kind of taste setters. in the whole of Japanese culture, because it is at their bidding that architects design tea rooms in a certain way, that potters make certain kinds of pottery, that bamboo craftsmen make certain kinds of ladles and spoons, that painters do certain kinds of painting and calligraphy, that gardeners make just such a garden, and so on. So they are conductors of an orchestra of artists. But what it was all based upon originally was that they discovered the marvelous quality of the everyday utensils used by peasants. Some of the most valuable tea bowls in the world, which now would sell for thousands of dollars in Japan, were originally nothing but the cheapest kind of rice bowls used by Korean peasants. But there is a tradition of Korean pottery, so that even the humblest article carries with it the genius of the great Korean artist, and this was originally derived from the Chinese potters of the Song Dynasty. And they saw in that simplest, most ordinary rice bowl, which was not, you see, anything like porcelain, but definitely ceramic, with a rough glaze, because these things were just turned out by the thousand. But every so often in those thousands, one, as it were, escaped the inspector, wasn't quite ordinary, and it was a work of genius, but unintentional genius. Nobody had thought that he was making a marvelous bowl at the time. But the tea master's eye, which was free from conception, could suddenly see that bowl. So also they found that nothing in the world could be more pleasant than listening to boiling water, the sound of the rain on the roof. The thing I learnt when I went to Japan was told me by a Zen master. The most important thing I learned in Japan was that the sound of the rain needs no translation. We were discussing translating Zen classics into English, and he said, don't bother. The sound of the rain needs no translation. So listening to that, listening to water boiling, smelling charcoal being made, and finally making a fire, drinking tea, very ordinary, secular, everyday pursuits, they discovered that all this was really marvelous. And therefore they went against elaborate arts, very ornate lacquerware, very ornate porcelain, or very ornate clothing. And they induced in that spirit into Japanese art, which today we call shibui. Shibui is Zen taste, and it's said that the taste of Zen and the taste of tea are the same. It's a pun. In Chinese, tea is cha, Zen is chan. So then, it is from this basis of quietness that there derives pleasure not only in the most ordinary things. I mean, you have this. Everybody loves the smell of coffee cooking in the morning. The smell of leaves burning on an autumn day, and the hazy blue smoke that comes from it. My father takes intense pleasure in untangling string, because he's a real contemplative. And things like that can become, for a person who is awake, as rich as anything you could buy with $1 million. Although it is said that when you are awakened, you are competent to spend 10,000 gold coins a day. Now, also going back to ritual, out of this state of appreciation of the most ordinary things, the ritualistic attitude in using them comes. Why? Because in doing anything, you are not in a hurry. After all, it's all here. And the preparation of a feast should be as enjoyable as the feast itself. And you can tell when you taste people's food whether they enjoyed preparing it or not. Most food in our world tastes as if it had been washed in detergents and boiled to be disinfected and served out of a sense of duty because it's good for you. Because, you see, we don't have any real relationship to the material world, to the present. We are always living for something else, for some abstract good. When you say something is good for you, what is this good that's good for you? Well, you'll survive, you see. You'll go on living if you eat food that's good for you. But there's no point in going on living just in order to eat more unpleasant food that's good for you. And you know, people have kitchens that look like bathrooms because it's a place where you do something that is sort of necessary, but you don't want it out in front, you see? And they have no color in them. They're just places to do something utilitarian. And when we do something utilitarian, boy, does it look it. You see, the kitchen should be the center of the home. And no food tastes as good as food that has been prepared under your nose. Watch it sizzling. See? So we have to return to a thorough appreciation of this. Because otherwise, we'll just be eating for the future. So the great cook always loves the raw materials. Like, what could be more beautiful than an egg? Or a potato? Or a slab of beef? Or a beautiful long silver fish? And you arrange these things on a board in your kitchen. And before cooking, you should always lay things out and enjoy their appearance sitting there. And then cooking is the art of loving a thing into superb edibility. And you have to hover over it. You mustn't switch it on, look at your watch, and then go away and read the newspaper, and when it's done, come back. You have to be there. And this, therefore, induces a ritualistic element, because it's important, too, to have all the things you're going to need laid out or hung in some orderly way so that you can get them exactly when you want it. And enjoy picking the spoon up, you know, or the knife, the beautiful feel of slicing something, you see. All that is a sort of a ritualistic thing. And all that attitude is in every moment of tea ceremony. The preparation of it is as important as the serving of it. And in serving of it, you're not just passing someone a cup, you know, here, have this. As if the cup were an unimportant vessel in which the thing that's good for you is there. See? It is that the very act of handing a person this thing, you see, is, you don't have to say it. It'd be too bad to say it or even think of it, but this is the play of the cosmic energy. This thing's going whammo. And there it is right there. So don't, it is saying, don't fritter away the moment. Every moment, present moment, is sacred moment. And live it. There's nothing else to do, as a matter of fact. You can't escape that. But so many people bolt their lives like bolting food. And then they wonder where it's all gone. You can, you know, slow down time. Everybody feels in a rush that time is just roaring by. Robinson Jeffers says time goes faster in California than anywhere else in America. Because that's everybody's been following the sun. And then they got stopped by the Pacific Ocean. And then the sun went down and they're still going west as far as possible to lengthen the day, to lengthen life, to hang on to this in the hope that somewhere along the line, someday, somehow, that great, voluptuous goody you were looking for is going to turn up. Never does. Because you can't seek it tomorrow. You can only find it now. So then, The ritualistic attitude is simply delight in material things, in handling them, born of inner serenity, which comes from knowing. Only we can't say what it is that we know, but just that you're it. And it's very funny. People say they don't know, but I can look into your eyes and I can see the Mother Goddess of the universe looking right at me. And people blinking their eyes and saying, what, me? I don't know anything. But those eyes, wowee, you look down into those.